You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com. Have you ever wondered what it's like inside a screenwriter's mind? In this podcast, we explore how successful screenwriters tackle structure, plot, character, dialogue, and the film business. Get ready to go down the rabbit hole of story as we pull the best interviews from the archives of the IFH Podcast Network. Let's travel inside the screenwriter's mind. This episode originally aired on the Make Your Movie with Dave Bullis podcast.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart.
Hey, Steve, thanks a lot for coming on the show, sir.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
So, you know, Steve, just to get started, I wanted to ask, what got you into the film industry? Was it, you know, did you like films as, you know, growing up, or was it just sort of one of those things where one day you found yourself, you know, sort of writing screenplays or on set somewhere?
Well,
as it tends to happen, right?
My story is a little different. I did love films. I was a huge film buff as a kid, and my dad supported that. And early on, when I was, 10 or 11, he bought a 8mm camera, and I was one of those kids who made movies in the backyard and tried to do special effects with gunpowder and gasoline, which he also supported, interestingly enough. And then my dad, then, when I went off to college, actually changed my life. I went off to college and said, I don't know what I should do. I guess I'll be a psychologist like my dad. That's what he was. And he came up after I'd been there a week or so, and he said, you know, what are your courses? And I said, oh, this is what I signed up for. And he said, well, this makes no sense. You've been making movies in the backyard for 10 years. What's going on? And he went to my advisors and he said, do you have anything like film or movies or television? And he changed my whole course schedule. This is absolutely true. And I had never thought about actually trying to do it for a living, even though I'd been making movies for years and years and doing stop motion animation. And then I, you know, never looked back. I went, oh, well, yeah. Because then, you know, then there were people in the departments. You know, we didn't have much of a film program at Penn State all those years ago. There were like one television course and like two film courses. And you had to borrow cameras from the local PBS station and whatnot. But, but that's how it happened. And then I got drafted. Then I went to USC, film graduate school. And there met a lot of the people that I still work with. And even though it took almost 10 years from graduating USC to actually break in and make Short Circuit, we were working in the film business, making short films and little short animated things and films for schools and libraries, TV commercials and whatnot.
You know, it's funny, Steve, that your dad was able to change your whole curriculum because, you know, I actually used to work at a college and grades and all that stuff were so secretive. They actually fired a professor one time because he told a student's father what he got in the class as a final grade.
Wow.
Before the kid did. And they actually just fired the professor on the spot because of it.
Wow.
Yeah. It's just, but no, that just, it's funny though. You know, it's funny how college has changed so much. But you know, you went to Penn State and, you know, I've actually, you know, been up there. I actually attended a Penn State football game. I didn't go there for college, but, you know, I've been there once.
Nittany Lions.
Small world, right? And because you're out in L.A. now, right?
I live in Arizona.
Oh, okay. You know, I actually have a few friends out there.
I go to L.A. when as needed.
I see. So, you know, just to ask, does Penn State ever ask you to come back to maybe talk about screenwriting or directing or anything?
I've been bad. It's funny. Ironic timing. You know, they occasionally send me alumni stuff. I've never let them even know what I do. I should do that. But no, they haven't. They haven't tracked me down. They have no idea, you know, who I am. I was kind of an invisible student, geeky guy, and I just went through and left.
Well, I thought maybe they'd have some kind of alumni, you know, sort of headhunter who kind of kept tracking all this stuff.
I've never responded to any of it. So I actually have it on my desk as we speak. I said, I should let them know. They probably would like to know.
So. Well, then you could just send them this podcast instead. You could say, I'm not going to go back. Just listen to this podcast. I'm talking to Dave. So, you know, you brought up Short Circuit. By the way, I watched that movie religiously as a kid, by the way. So I want to ask, you know, about your whole writing style. I'm actually always fascinated by people's writing styles and their approach to their own art. So I wanted to ask you, Steve, how do you approach writing? You know, do you subscribe to any sort of methods? Do you do very long treatments first, or do you just sort of jump right into writing?
Brent and I, who have written practically everything together, at least certainly everything has been made, and we've been working since the days at USC, both in the short films, and then we wrote Short Circuit, which was our big break. We have a very our approach is outline. We don't normally write a treatment. For Tremors, we did, only because we were trying to sell it, and we couldn't sell it as a pitch because we couldn't. And the treatment didn't sell either, by the way. But let me go back. So we outline in great detail. We are not comfortable until we know where the story is going, and we're very story oriented. Some people can start, you know, sort of with a character. They'll just say, oh, there's this character and he's a drug addict and he's got these problems and I'm just going to think about what he does because he's a drug addict. We can't do that. We got to know where we're going. So, and we can't really get excited about something until we know where we're going. Even if it's a rewrite, which, you know, you get offered quite a bit in Hollywood. That's pretty much all Hollywood does anymore. Even if it's a rewrite, we will sit down before we even say yes to a job. We'll say, okay, we got to go through this movie, figure out what we would change, or maybe they're telling us what they want changed. We got to be sure that we can make that work, and we got to know where it's going. Because your ending is so important in a movie, in our opinion. In fact, somebody well-known, maybe one of the Zucker brothers, said, your ending is 50% of your movie. Somebody said that, and we kind of believe that. So we got to know where we're going, what the surprises are, where the twists and turns are. So long answer to that question is we outline like crazy. In fact, we used to drive studios crazy back in the day, early on when we were getting started. You used to get 12 weeks was a normal time to write a script. And we would outline for 8. And they'd be calling us, so you're writing? Are you writing? Well, no, we're still outlining. They're like, are you out of your mind? And but then we would write it in, 4 weeks because it was done.
So, you know, you mentioned Tremors when you finally started outlining. Was there ever sort of an impetus for that movie where you said, you know what, this is where we want to take it? So, you know what I mean? So we already know, you know, what the monster's going to be, and we sort of know where the location's going to be. It's going to be in perfection. Was that a part of it, or did that sort of come in during the outlining phase?
Well, there again, we outlined it in great detail, worked on it with Ron Underwood, because the goal with Tremors was to become producers. We were frustrated that everything we had written up till then, we discovered, naive that writers aren't really welcome on the set. Once you're done with the script, they don't want to hear from you again. And we would go to movies that we had written and go, boy, that's not what I would have done. And our agent told us, well, look, you guys want to produce, then you want control. And to get that, you're going to have to control the material from the get-go. You can't be rewriting the studio's material, blah, blah, blah. So she said, what do you have in your portfolio, in your piles of notes? And we came out of our piles of notes with, we got this underground monster idea. And she said, that's kind of cool. I've never heard of that before. And so first we sat down with Ron and we outlined the whole story, figured out who the characters were, where it was going to go. And then we pitched it all over town, couldn't sell it. And then she said, well, let's maybe you should write a treatment. We wrote a very detailed, like 25-page treatment. Did not sell. Sent it to everybody. So she said, well, I guess you're going to have to write it on spec. So in between, you know, the regular Hollywood movies we were writing Tremors on spec. And then took that all over town. And it was a huge, our agent was a huge part of getting this done. She was central. We call her the mother of Tremors. This is Nancy Roberts, later our partner in Stampede Entertainment. She handpicked, you know, who the script was going to. She did what an agent really is supposed to do. She handpicked who the script. She knew the studio people. She told us in advance what they were going to say. You know, there were situations where because of her relationships, there were certain times if she had a spec script, she couldn't not show it to certain people because then they would be mad that they were shut out of the process. So she said, okay, this is going to be weird. I have to send this to Disney. They are going to say, we hate this because it's got so much dust in it. The head hates dust. And we're like, what? Sure enough, that's exactly what came back. And all of this was, of course, off the record, you know, under the wire. But she got off the phone. I think I was there at some point. No, she was on the phone to somebody at Disney, and they were passing in a very, you know, polite way. Said, well, it's not, you know, right for us at this time. And she said, come on, Eisner doesn't like dust. And there's tons on the other end. but all really true. And then she handpicked Jim Jacks, a wonderful, wonderful executive, classic old school executive, who at Universal, who loved movies, loved all kinds of movies, knew exactly what Tremors was. He saw exactly its B-movie, monster movie roots. And she knew that Jim would get it and he would fight for it at Universal, which is exactly what happened. And then she enlisted Gail Ann Hurd. She was the one who brought Gail Ann Hurd in because Gail Ann looked at our buddy Ron's short movies, which is all he had at the time. He had not done a feature when we did Tremors. And the studio was like, well, we're going to hand off this movie to a guy who's only directed films for schools and libraries. And Gail looked at the movies. Come on, the guy's a filmmaker. Don't worry about it. And then she shepherded us, especially at the beginning, you know, made sure we weren't going off the rails in some way to get her in trouble as she was executive producer. And then she saw the dailies and said, good, this is going to work.
Yeah, you know, I really like Tremors. And I'm going to tell you why, Steve. Because, you know, first, it just seems everything happens naturally. You know what I mean? It's, you know, and again, when you said you started with characters, you know, when you were working with the idea, it's because, you know, all those characters seem like they're real people who live in that world. And they all see, you know, and when they, you know, when some of them finally die, for anyone listening who hasn't seen it yet, I'm not going to spoil it. But for any of those, when they finally die, you know, you actually say, oh my gosh, you know, there isn't a ton of guys, you know, that are just getting mauled. These are all the characters right here. So when they finally die, when some of them die, they go, oh my gosh, you know, that actually is impactful in the story.
Thank you.
It's those escalating circumstances. You know what I mean?
That's very nice to hear.
Oh, well, my, you know, you're very welcome. And, you know, and, cause when you see the worm for the first time, you think that's the monster and then it becomes bigger and you're always escalating that further and further and further. And it's always, you know, they find a solution, the problem escalates. They find a solution, the problem escalates. I mean, that's just, it's phenomenal. And I don't know if you know who Red Letter Media is, but they actually are a popular online review group, and they actually gave it a, you know, they actually have this one segment where they talk about movies they like, and they actually reviewed Tremors, and they said it's one of their favorite movies.
Oh, great. It's always nice to hear. All of the things you're saying we worked very hard on. They were all very important to us. My partner is not a B-movie monster fan. I saw them all, you know, up until the mid-70s or so. I saw everything. And I knew all the cliches we were playing with. My partner is just all about character. And again, in both of us, it was very important that the characters matter, that they seem, that the plot things that happen seem to come naturally out of the situation. And even the monsters are consistent in what they do. You know, they don't change the rules. They don't suddenly become indestructible or anything like that.
And one other compliment I want to give you, too, is the way that you constructed this with sound. Because you know what I mean? Like in the beginning when Earl and I forget Kevin Bacon's character.
Val.
Earl and Val, when they're looking for, the doctor, they're not yelling his name. They're just sort of walking around and you can really, you know, they're hearing the planks walk. You hear the bucket kick. And you're, you know, and then, you know, Val says, well, you know, where's that music coming from? You know what I mean? And it always escalates with that sound. And then when you have Chang's drugstore, you have that refrigerator that always makes that noise. And then that causes, you know, further conflict. I mean, that's really, really good writing and using that audio for filmmaking.
Oh, yeah. We knew sound was going to be critical. We were a low budget movie. That's part of the reason we picked Underground Monster as one of the ideas that we decided to develop. We thought, oh, well, they're underground most of the time. We'll never see them. And heaven knows we had endless problems, even though we, in theory, weren't seeing them. But we knew that sound was going to be critical. We had great sound people. You know, and it was, you know, years ago, people have asked me, you know, what is the bass sound of a graboid? And sadly, I don't know. And I've lost track of the people who invented that sound.
Yeah, you know, because for everyone that's seen the movie, you know, that's that sound that they make, you know, and it just all ties in very well together. And everyone, I'm going to link to Tremors in the show notes to buy off Amazon or Best Buy, because it's totally recommended watching. I remember seeing Tremors years ago, Steve, and it just blew me away. but see, and I didn't know what I was watching because, you know, now, you know, I've studied filmmakers. I've studied this. When I go back now, I can sort of go through with a surgeon's scalpel and I can pick out all this stuff. Oh, this is why I found this so fascinating. You know what I mean? And that's this great. Is why I found this so entertaining. Hello. So then I get to talk to the guy who wrote it and you know what I mean? And made it. Yeah. So now you can tell me how wrong I am. No, I'm just kidding. Oh. But it's just it's a phenomenal film, and that's why I'm so glad, you know, that the, you know, I got to see the franchise, you know what I mean, like Tremors 2, Tremors 3. You know, I know you guys, you did 4 as well, and you also did the TV series. Right. And it was always great to see, you know, this sort of franchise expand. And, you know, because, you know, I always talk to, you know, my friends and always say, you know, some franchises, you know, they sort of go this way, some go that way. You know, I mean, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street. But Tremors always sort of kept it in perfection one way or another, because there was always, you know what I mean? There was always a sort of reason why you know, like in Tremors 3, when it's called Back to Perfection, right? And that's where Melvin's creating that whole town, right? And mm-hmm. that leads into the whole TV series. But it's just stuff like that. You know what I mean? That's, it's all comes organically.
Well, it was very important to us to make the world consistent. And it wasn't easy. You know, we never expected even to do Tremors 2. That came along years later only because of the success of VHS. You know, Tremors 1 was not a huge hit. I mean, you know, Kevin Bacon viewed it as a flop, and he absolutely disowned it for many, many years. And it wasn't a flop per se, but it did not do nearly what the studio hoped it would do, and they were disappointed. And so we were floored, and we got this call from the video department who said, "Hey, what about Tremors 2?" We said, "What about it?" They said, "We want it." We said, "What?" So then we all had to sit down because we were busy doing all kinds of other stuff at that point in our careers, and we said, God, can we come up with a Tremors 2? And then, you know, then we said, well, all right, the big cliche is there's a queen graboid. And we all went, okay, no way we're doing a queen graboid. We're not going to do it. And what do we do instead of that? And then finally, I'm going to say it was me. I think it was me. I was driving along in the desert, as I often am. And I said, I wonder if they just turn into something small. How weird would that be? And then we ran with that idea.
Yeah, and I remember seeing that too, because that's when they were actually walking on land. I forget the name that in the movie that the characters give them.
Shriekers, but, they call them.
Shriekers, that's right, yeah. And then because it's the third that they're called Ass Blasters, right?
Well, that's their third incarnation. That that told us where to go with the third one. We thought, okay, well, they'll change into a third form. And at the time, again, it was really important to us to keep the characters consistent, the rules consistent, other than but still come up with surprises. You can't just do the same thing over and over. So that's how we came up with the Ass Blasters. And in fact, the effects guys, Tom Woodruff and Alec Gillis of Amalgamated Dynamics, are the ones who came up with Ass Blasters. because they were just as invested in we were in protecting their monsters and making them consistent. And they have a wonderful design approach. It's very real-world based. They have volumes and volumes of books about animals and creatures and skin textures. And they literally came in one day and said, hey, are you aware of the bombardier beetle? And we're like, no, we're not. They said, that's a beetle that mixes chemicals in its butt and makes it sound like a firecracker. And we're like, that's a real thing? Absolutely. And we think that's what ass blasters should do. And we're like, we are totally on board with that. There was something else I was going to say. Oh, yes. And then we got thrown a curve by Universal because they said, okay, Tremors 3 will definitely be the last one. There will definitely not be any more. We understand our market perfectly. And we know exactly how the DVD world works. And this is it. So we said, okay, we'll wrap it up. That's cool. We will say that this is the last form that creatures take. Boom, the end, goodbye, perfection. And almost immediately was, oh, no, we did really much better than we thought. We must have Tremors 4.
Yeah, because I actually saw Tremors 4, and I actually was kind of shocked because I thought, you know, because I was like, oh, wow, I didn't know they made another one. And you know what? This is funny, Steve. Here, you know, as you could kind of tell I'm a movie buff. I didn't even know you did a TV series. I actually didn't know you did a TV series until last year.
Well, it's easy to do. I mean, there's so much material now. There's a lot of stuff that I don't know. I mean, the stuff that's being, you know, I'm probably not even up on half of Netflix's shows and all this stuff. But anyway, I don't blame you.
Well, because, you know, I'm such a movie head and I'm always like, you know, looking for different stuff. And I said, they did a Tremors TV series before. I said, wow, I didn't notice that. So I actually bought it offline and I actually went through and I was like, oh, okay. So it sets up, it's, you know, it's three into the TV series and then four is a prequel.
Yeah.
You know, I have to ask, you know, when you make these Tremor movies, Michael Gross seems like the coolest guy in the world. Is he the coolest guy in the world? Because I mean, he just seems like he would just be an awesome guy to hang out with.
He is. He's just a wonderful, funny, intellectual, not full of himself actor. He's great on the set, you know, at understanding, you know, who has the scene. You know, he's not trying to, you know, steal other people's lines or anything. He's an actor's actor. And he's become, you know, he became Bert. He took over Bert, you know, from us. and he would always, on Tremors 2 and 3 and 4, even though he wasn't playing Bert, he would always come to the set with little delicately penciled lines in the script. And then he wouldn't sit down with me. We'd sit down with us before we went. He'd say, okay, I got this idea for a change here and change here. And then we could go back and forth. It was, well, if you say that, then we won't know this. He'd say, oh, yeah, you're right. Never mind. But a lot of times, you know, especially with the Bert character, he defends the character. And he loves it. I thought at some point, I thought he was going to get tired of it. But I always have to tell this quick story. He was a huge television star when he did Tremors 1. He had just finished years and years on Family Ties playing a guy who could not be more different from Bert. And they asked us to read him because he was a big television star and they felt like that would help the movie. And we went, read the father on Family Ties? And we went, well, okay, we'll do it because they want us to do it. Well, he blew us away. You know, he came in because he's an actor, and he completely just, Ron tells a story that he was actually jumping up on his desk at one point, showing how afraid he was of the Monster Underground. Anyway, then some years later, Michael told me the story of walking down the street in New York and getting that look that fans get when they start to recognize you. And the guy was walking toward him, and he sees the look. He knows the fan's going to say it. And then the fan says, you're that crazy gun guy. And Michael said, yes, I finally escaped Family Ties.
I thought you were going to say, oh, yeah, I was the dad on Family Ties, crazy gun guy. Yeah, you know, it's funny because I introduced a friend of mine to Tremors, and he actually goes, wait a minute, that's the dad from Family Ties. Yeah. And I said, yes, he's with the Heaton family.
Yeah.
And Keaton, not Heaton. And I said, yeah, you know, and he goes, wow. He goes, this is a different role for him. And I said, yeah. And I said, he fits it like a glove. Because one of my favorite shots of the whole movie is where Reba McEntire and Michael Gross are in their underground bunker, and the wall starts to shake. and they see the graboid come through, and they start to fire. They have those rifles, those bolt action rifles, and they're out of ammo very quickly. And the camera just pans over to the wall of guns, and they literally just are pulling guns off the wall. And I mean, it's so, if again, organic characters, and that fits so well, because I would actually be disappointed, Steve, if they did not have a wall of guns.
Yeah. Oh, we knew that was a key moment in the movie, and it was great at the premieres and at the test screenings. You know, the audience would laugh through the next, all the way through the next scene.
Yeah, it was a phenomenon. Tremors is definitely one of my favorite movies. And I think, you know, when I go back to, you know, writing my own stuff, you know, I always like to dissect movies that I've watched, you know, and I like to dissect movies that I've really liked. And, you know, and now, because this podcast, I get to talk to people who've written great stuff that I like. So, you know, it's just great being able to talk to you, Steve, and you know, finding out these little intricacies. I think I just butchered that word, by the way, but you know, and I want to ask, you know, Steve, you know, you have such a great career. You know, you did Short Circuit, Batteries Not Included, Short Circuit 2, Tremors, as we all just talked about. You did Ghost Dad. You know, is there any sort of writing advice you could give to anyone listening who's writing a screenplay right now?
Well, if you like our style, and that's step number one, if you like the movies we've done, then do what you're doing. First of all, analyze the stuff you like. That's a lot of, you know, pros, if we'll call ourselves that, would say that. Because you won't be copying the stuff that you like. You'll be learning from it. You know, you obviously understand setups and payoffs, for example, which is a big thing for me and Brent. Setting something up early in the movie, having it pay off later in a surprising way. Those are hard to do. It's hard to do those correctly and without cheating. And a lot of times you see movies cheat. I feel a little at odds with kind of the current movie-making scene, giving anybody advice, because film after film that has no plot and makes no sense is wildly successful. And I've begun to wonder, you know, I rail at this and I go, oh, in my day, and blah, blah, blah. And yet, you know, this is for years now I've been seeing this. I've started to think, well, the audience has really changed. I think the younger audience maybe does not care as much about what I think is important in storytelling, and they truly do enjoy these movies. You know, part of me says, well, they don't really enjoy them. It's just that's the only thing on this weekend, so they go. I'm less and less sure of that. But anyway, I would say analyze the stuff you like, whatever it is. You know, if it's Ordinary People, analyze that. And write a lot, by the way. You'll hear this too from other people. Don't get hung up on your one script. Brent and I did this, you know, early on. We would write a script and go over and over and over and over. And we've looked at one of those early scripts. This was like four or five scripts before Short Circuit. You know, we go, well, it wasn't very good, and none of the versions we did were very good. It just wasn't very good. You gotta move on. Write something, get it done, say goodbye to it, write something else. If you're a writer, you have plenty of ideas. And the worst case is you find out, well, maybe I don't like it. You know, you do four or five scripts and you go, I don't like this. That's fine too. But write a lot. Don't get hung up on one thing and, you know, and beat it to death. You know, push yourself to a degree, look outside your comfort zone. Although I do think that, you know, if you like emotional, what's the Julianne Moore picture she just did, where she was a lady with Alzheimer's? I can't remember the name of it. That's a very emotional picture that I would never try to write, right? But maybe, you know, other people would. They would think that's exactly the kind of movie I want to do. Study those, and write a lot. I've already said what I'm going to say.
You know, that's great advice. You know, Steve, just going through and analyzing, you know, movies that you like and why you like those. And like, for instance, I had Victor Miller on here, and Victor Miller wrote Friday the 13th Part 1, by the way, which also starred Kevin Bacon, by the way.
Wow. So, I did not know that.
Yes. Yes. Small world, right? So, you know, and we were talking about, you know, how do you break it down? And Victor said, listen, he goes, I've been doing this for 30 years now, whatever. And he said, I'm still always looking for different ways of writing and telling a story. He goes, so, and he said to me that, you know, he's always looking for a different method, something to sort of crack the story or another way to write. And, you know, it's just very reassuring and unassuring at the same time to hear veterans like you and him, you know, just talk about screenwriting and always say, you know, they even with hits, because Tremor, I mean, because again, you've had Tremors, you've had, you know, Short Circuit, and, you know, even, and he's, you know, had Friday the 13th Part 1. He's had a few Emmy award winning pieces, and it's reassuring, and it's a little worrisome to hear that, you know, they still don't have it all figured out.
Oh,
you know what I mean? Even after these hits.
Every script has its own life that it takes on and its own problems that it throws at you, and you suddenly find yourself going, why did I even like this idea? I feel so trapped now. And, and sometimes you're beating your head against the wall, but you know, that's the great thing. It is a creative process. Each one is different. Brent and I are doing one right now, as a matter of fact, that is very different from anything we've ever done. Ron challenged us. He said, you know what, I would really like to do another low-budget movie. Ron is big in television right now. He's directed every TV show you've ever heard of. And he goes from show to show to show. And he said, you know, it'd be fun to do another low-budget movie like we did Tremors. Why don't you guys write a sci-fi movie with no special effects? And we went, really, Ron? And then we thought about it. We sat down, and so we actually have come up with an idea. We're about, I don't know, halfway through the process now, our anguishing process. It was really hard. I mean, we just had to throw out idea after idea after idea until we came up with this idea that I don't want to talk about. But anyway, yes. Good note, yes. Good writers are always questioning what they're doing and always, a lot of times, I think, floundering quietly in their dark corners.
And, you know, I'm not even a professional writer yet, Stephen, but I often feel that
keep
way.
Writing.
I always feel like, what the hell did I start? It's funny. I actually pitched an idea one time and the producer hated it, right? And he came back to me later on and he goes, you know what? This is late, months later, and he was already working on something else, but he goes, you know what? I was driving down this interstate, and he goes, you know, and all of a sudden I couldn't stop thinking about your script idea, and I started laughing to myself, and he goes, you know, it was a lot better than I thought.
That's
it was.
Funny.
And I said, see, it's always those rose-colored glasses.
That's a rare producer. That's great.
Yeah. Steve, you know, we've been talking for about 30 minutes now, and I just want to ask you in closing, is there anything that, you know, we didn't get a chance to discuss that you wanted to, or is there any sort of thing you want to say, sort of put a period at the end of this whole conversation?
I'm writing novels now. I'd like to mention that, to plug them, among the other things I'm trying to do. But as far as it seems like was there anything else advice wise I would say, nothing springs to mind. I'm much better with questions.
Where can people find you at online?
Oh, well, the Stampede Entertainment maintains a website, and we always have hopes that we will sell something of our own and ramp up into production. Stampede-entertainment.com. And then I'm on Facebook, of course, as S.S. Wilson. And the books are available at Amazon, Tucker's Monster and Freddy Cats.
And I will link to all that in the
Thank
show
you.
Notes, everyone. Oh, my pleasure.
You have an impressive list of podcasts, by the way. There's like 150 of them or something.
Yeah, like 127 or 8. Now,
oh, okay. Well, I overstated it a little bit, but I was quite impressed when I went to your site and I listened to a few things, of course, before I agreed to do this. And so I was impressed with your polished approach.
Oh, thank you. I've actually been proud of that because I had somebody, I won't say who, but they came on and they said, Dave, thank you for not being that guy. And I said, what do you mean? They said, you know, they said, like, there's so many people who have podcasts now, and they said, you know, they're sort of like in their mom's basement, and they get people on the podcast so they can just like sort of like be malicious, you know what I mean? And it's just like, oh, so you made a movie, huh? What do you and I'm like, no, I would never be that guy. I hate people like, because I actually, Steve, you know, real quick, I was on a podcast with a friend of mine. And he asked me to be on his podcast. So I went to his house, which, by the way, we went to his mom's basement to record this. And then he started going like, oh, so you made a TV pilot and pitched it to NBC, huh? And I said, yeah. Well, is that bad? And he's like, well, I didn't, you know. And he's, this is the podcast, by the way. And he's like, oh, it kind of reminds me too much of Clerks. I said, wow. Oh, I said, yeah. I was like, and honestly, Steve, I'm pretty good at thinking on my feet. So what I did was I started, you know, I was like, if I started insulting you right now, dude, I said, believe me, I said you would cut this all out. And then finally, he started to like ease up a little bit after we exchanged little words. But yeah, I never would bring somebody on just to insult them. And I thank God that I've never had one bad podcast. I've never had anybody had bad feelings. Everything's always been great. So I'm proud of that.
Good. Well, you should be. That's good to hear. And I'm forewarned. I haven't had that experience yet.
So I can put you, yeah, I can give you that warning. I'll be like the harbinger of horror. You know what I mean? Like always warning you about things that are coming. Kind of like old Fred in Tremors, but he didn't tell them. But his dead body showed them that there was something right out there. Steve, I want to say thank you very much for coming on the podcast, sir. And please stay in touch. If you need anything, let me know.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Take care, bro.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Inside the Screenwriter's Mind at screenwritersmind.com.